Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. We welcome you again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. Hello to all. This is Milton Rosenberg.
We'll talk about that tonight on Extension 720.
Chicago, the region around. Justin Kaufman here on Extension 720. 720 WGN with you till 10 o'clock. A truncated Extension 720 tonight as the White Sox have the night off. You heard Andre and the reporters. We're on till 10 o'clock, so we got you back for a couple hours here. We got some great stuff to talk about, mostly healthcare tonight. Two conversations, one with Dan Weissman, who's a longtime journalist from Chicago, who worked for places like Marketplace, which is the big sort of financial show that's on public radio. But Dan Weissman does a new podcast called An Arm and a Leg, which is really looking at the personal side, telling stories about the impact of the cost of healthcare. And he thought, you know, when he started out in this podcast, he would try to do something new, and he really was reflective of who he was and what he was going through as a freelancer. And he started to realize that this podcast is going to continue as he keep calling out for different people to tell him their stories. They just keep coming. And it's all these crazy stories about how they got a bill that they didn't know they were going to get, or what insurance said they were going to cover and they didn't cover, or just the cost of everything. Dan Weissman joins me coming up here at 8:30 to talk about his podcast and his new season, season two of An Arm and a Leg. So we'll talk about that coming up. Also, new book, The Unspeakable Mind. Dr. Shelley Jain is a professor at Stanford. She's also part of the VA at Palo Alto in California. And she's one of the leading scientists looking at PTSD research. And, you know, of course, we've talked a lot about trauma and about PTSD, and it's really become something that at a different time in our society, in our culture, in our civilization, we called it all other things, whether it be shell-shocked or, you know, in case of a lot of the military and war that we've had throughout our time, there's always been a PTSD around it. It's just a question of what we called it. And as Dr. Jain kind of looks through this stuff, they talk about, you know, what is PTSD, how does it manifest, and also how does it stick around in our bodies? I mean, we could pass it on to the next generation. That's what they're seeing, that DNA sequences are showing cells and you know, just different parts of our DNA that are being affected by trauma and passed on to the next generation. We'll talk with Dr. Jain about the tremendous research they're doing on this, and it's really opening up because there are times in our society we didn't really research it. We didn't really put a lot of science behind it. So Dr. Jain and others in California are doing so, and she's got a new book called The Unspeakable Mind, and we will be talking with her coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. How about that? Two great combos right there. Pete Zimmerman here, as he always is. Pete, good to see you. Good to hear from you. How are you?
Hey, I'm great. How are you?
How was the weekend?
It was great. Yeah. Yeah.
You are a foster family for pets.
Yeah.
So you have, how many cats and dogs did you have in your house in the last week?
We had 9 animals at one point.
9. And I saw on social media yesterday on Instagram that 2 of them found new homes.
Yep.
Is that hard for you that you spend time with them for a couple months and then I mean, obviously they're going to good homes, but
yeah,
is it hard as a foster dad?
You know, you get attracted to certain animals. The more they're around, how they interact with you and how they interact with their other animals. Yeah, it's always a little bit bittersweet.
Are there sometimes, just by that statement, are there sometimes where you're like, I never really clicked with this animal?
Yeah.
It's time to go.
We fostered dogs in the past too, and dogs, I'm always ready for the dogs to to move on. The cats are so easy. You know, they just sit around.
Well, I am in awe of you and Molly doing that and opening your home to do that, because it's amazing. I would have such a hard time with that.
Yeah.
But good job. And it's got to be tough when they leave.
Yeah.
So now that with two of them out, you have seven now?
Now we have four. We have a mama and three kittens, and then, you know, our own three animals. Yeah. So,
Do they have the prospects that they're going to be adopted?
Yeah, looking good for the mom. Kittens will fit and we'll figure that out. We've named them after the Partridge Family because there's a mom and three kittens, and the one kitten is a really bright red cat. So that's Danny.
And then, and the other two play tambourine, so it's kind of perfect.
So that's Shirley, Danny, Lori, and Keith.
There you go. And they don't have to, they can be renamed, right?
We don't allow renaming. No, of course. Yeah, whatever.
We got our cats, or one of our cats, from Alive Rescue, which is the, and they just had a party. They got a new space. We went to the party the other day. And I forgot that we renamed the cat. Like, they had, his name was like Whiskers or something when he was there. And we're like, oh, do you remember? And they're like, no. And I'm like, oh, I mean, Whiskers. And they're like, oh, Whiskers. Yeah, we remember Whiskers, but I can remember there's different names. So I've been trying the last couple days to see if Whiskers works on the cat.
You remember?
Yeah. Hey, Whiskers. Whiskers. And it still, it has that apathetic,
like
I'm
most
not gonna,
cats.
Yeah, not going to pay attention to you, whatever you call me. So it worked out just fine. All right, David Jennings got the news tonight. We'll take a quick break, come back. I'll talk about it. I did get the fishing done. We talked about it last week. I did go fishing this week for Father's Day, so we'll talk about that. And Dan Weissman and Dr. Shelley Jane coming up here on Extension 720. Stay with us.
Well, now take down your fishing pole and meet me at the fishing hole. We may not get a bite all day, but don't you rush away. What a great place to rest your bones, and mighty fine for skipping stones. You'll feel fresh as a lemonade, setting in the shade.
720 WGN, Extension 720, Justin Kaufman here. You're listening last week. I was talking a lot about Father's Day and my and this romantic notion of going fishing with my dad and my son to really sort of capture the spirit of Father's Day. That was the idea, right? And I talked a little bit about how I hadn't done it in a long time, told some stories of some family fishing expeditions to Wonder Lake when we lived up in McHenry County. So we decided to do that this weekend, and it took me about, I was excited. We had these fishing poles that were bought one Christmas holiday ago and were never taken out of the package, that kind of thing. So we took them up and we were excited. And I forget, it took me about, I would say, 35 to 45 seconds once the pole was constructed to recognize how I, what I remembered about fishing, and that it, it's one of those sports that if that is classified as such, that you spend a lot of time complaining about the equipment and cursing the equipment because it won't do what you want it to do. The fishing line is spooled out. I can't get it to spool back in. I'm trying to get the reel in, and then I got to cut the line. And it's getting it's all intertwined, and it's getting these little knots. Then you got to tie the lure on there, and we go down to the pond that's near my parents' property.
So you're just fishing off a pier. You're not in a boat or anything.
No, my brother came with two, and he was upset that I had not organized this to charter a boat. Like it was Costa Rica or something. He's like, I thought we were going on a boat on Lake Geneva or something. I'm like, no, what are you talking about? That? No, I'm talking about the folded chair, you know, the lawn chair that you bring down to the pier, got the fishing hat on and the cooler, and you sit there and you ask, you know, deep questions while you cast out into the pond. No chairs, no coolers.
Oh, man.
Question one. How soon can I start complaining to my friends about how lousy this fishing rod
exactly.
is?
Exactly. That was
why those damned lures didn't work the way they promised me they would.
Well, the best part about it was I thought we would be able to, I don't know what I'm doing, but I thought that we'd be able to put a shovel into the ground and there would be worms. And then we would just, or we'd go to the bait shop
right,
and get night crawlers. We talked about that. But we weren't leaving the property. There's a vast amount of property there. So the idea was, can we just put a shovel in and get some worms? No worms. No, I don't know why, but there are like the five different places that we, these are the woods. It's not like it's my crappy foyer in front of my house where I, you know, there's no worms because it's not real dirt. You know, this is real dirt.
Well, do you remember how you reacted the first time you had to bait a hook with a live worm?
Well, that's the thing. I don't. As a kid, I don't remember that at all. And I wanted that. I wanted to give that to my son, but I also wanted to reveal that. And it never happened. So all we had was these old lures. And I'm not kidding. They were the same lures from when we fished in Wonder Lake. My dad took out this dusty, moldy thing, and he opens it up, and it's the same stuff. And I'm like, rusted out hook type thing. I'm like, we're going to get tetanus off this. Get lockjaw from this stuff. So anyway, we get down there, and we start casting. And because the lures aren't the right lures, you know, they're for big fish or something like these are little bluegills and stuff. Nobody cares. When you get close to the dock, you can see the bluegills kind of looking at it. You can see in the clear water, and they're just like, there's never been fishing in here before, so I don't know what's happening, but I'll play with it a little bit. But they didn't bite. They were just like, I know this is not food.
That's when you get the net out. Just grab them by the net.
And we did catch one fish. It was a little bluegill. And this was the part, again, that I forgot about. So I was excited because it happened, and I was like, oh, there's a little bit of adrenaline. It was a very small fish. Appropriate amount of adrenaline for the small fish. And we get it up there, and that fish, you know, could not cooperate. It starts wiggling and jumping around, and I'm trying to grab it to be like, I'm going to grab it like they do in River Monsters or whatever. Oh, look at this fish. Look at the side. You see how it's blue here, and it's orange here. You know, I want to do that.
Yeah.
But I couldn't get the thing to stop moving around. And I'm like, I'm trying to be confident, like, to grab it, but it's just, like, jumping. It's all slimy. So I finally get it. And of course, because this happens every time you fish. Oh, this hook's not coming out right. So I've never in the history of fishing ever been a time where you just go bloop and the hook comes out and you put the fish back in. You're like, that was fun. Did you see the blue and the orange on that fish? No, this fish is spastic. I get it. They're out of water. And they're like, what's happening? And then, me and my dad are trying to get the hook out. And it's like trying not to rip the lip and the whole bit. And it was just like so traumatic. Like at the end of the day, I was like, this is too much. Fish goes back in. I'm worried that, you know, the fish was out for too long. So this fish is going to die right in front of my son. He's going to have a little trauma off of the fact that we killed this fish. The fish swam away. It was fine. And at the end, my son was like, when he got back home, and I think it was last night, and talked to my wife, he was like, yeah, I was kind of annoyed because I really wanted to see the fish and touch the fish, and Papa just threw it back into the pond.
Oh.
And I'm like, yeah, but, and it's not my dad's fault because we had such a hard time getting that hook out that the fish started, like, was dying.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, it was mm-hmm. life or death at that point.
Yeah,
the fish had stopped moving.
Fish's life, yeah.
So I was a little annoyed. I wanted to say, why didn't you look at it while we were pulling the hook out of there?
Yeah, what was he doing?
Yeah, I don't know. He was just, like, waiting. I think he was waiting for his turn to, like, I don't think he understood that there was a finite amount of time that you could have for the fish to be out of the water.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah, but he enjoyed it. He actually said it was his favorite thing, and he liked going fishing. Yeah, and I was surprised.
So that means you have to go back.
Yeah, maybe. Or maybe we have to charter that boat my brother was talking about, because this was not the experience. This was not it. It seems like it'll be a good experience for him. He'll look back and go, oh, we went fishing. And he'll remember it kind of like I did with Wonder Lake, where he's just like, oh, this romanticized idea. Mm-hmm. And we went down there with my dad, and he put the lure on, and we caught a fish. It was a big fish. It was a big trout. It was just two-inch bluegill.
Yeah.
And we had no problems whatsoever. That hook came right out. That's what he's going to remember. I, unfortunately, was too much in the moment to go, ugh, all right, this is something that I probably am not going to do again. So. Thanks, David. Justin Kaufman, Extension 720 here on 720 WGN, with you till 10 o'clock tonight. Coming up, The Unspeakable Mind, Dr. Shelley Jane, who is a medical director for integrated care at the VA in Palo Alto, as well as a professor at Stanford. We'll talk about her new book, The Unspeakable Mind, Stories of Trauma and Healing from the Front Lines of PTSD Science. She's one of the four foremost scientists who's researching this issue, and of course, has a lot to talk about when it comes to trauma, but also about how we move trauma from one generation to another. It could be hereditary. That's something that they're looking into research. So that's a fascinating topic and conversation coming up at 9 o'clock here on Extension 720. Well, there's a story today on NPR, npr.org, about a woman who had spinal surgery. She had insurance. She paid her bills. And then out of nowhere, a new bill came in the mail for $94,000. What? It was for a very specific warning system that was used to alert doctors if they were getting too close to the nerves. No one's arguing that that wasn't important, but the third-party company charged the insurance company almost six figures for something that most experts say shouldn't have been more than a fraction of that cost. And the insurance company wouldn't cover it, so the price got pushed to the patient. I'm sure this is not a new story to you, or maybe you have your own personal experiences with the healthcare system. And that's precisely why my former colleague and marketplace journalist Dan Weissman started a new podcast called An Arm and a Leg. It's a collection of stories of the healthcare system run amok. He just started season two. In it, he talks to several people who talk about their experiences with confusing procedures and complex billing and rage-inducing practices from the medical community and healthcare providers. Like this story from Blake. It's simple. He just needed a leg brace.
And I was thinking, you know, I wonder what they're going to charge the insurance company for this brace. And I looked on the side and I'm like, hey, you know, Google it. And I Google it. And then I found this one medical supply company brand new for $150. I kind of put it in the back of my head. Enjoyed using the brace as much as possible. Yeah. And then the bill came.
And what did it say?
$1,400 for a brace I could have walked home, well, hobbled home, and Googled and had it in-house the next day for $150, brand new.
And you double, triple-checked that this was the exact same thing?
Exact same, exact. Went right to the manufacturer's website, looked at where I could buy it. Yeah, no, it's the exact same brace from the exact same manufacturer, not refurbished, not reused, nothing.
Or how about Liz? Liz just needed an MRI when she got the bill that said she had to pay $1,600 out of pocket. The first thing she did was take it to social media.
And I thought, ooh, I'm going to do a screenshot of this bill and share it in that Facebook group because clearly something is wrong here and somebody on the internet will tell me that I really don't have to pay $1,600 and all I need to do is ask this one question and magically I won't have to pay this money anymore and I'll go to Disneyland. And so I took a screenshot, crossed out identifying info and just said, hey, what is this really what I have to pay? And everybody's like, yeah, that is your portion. Sorry to break it to you.
But Liz, not unlike Blake, was forced to comparison shop. She needed another MRI, so instead of following a referral from a doctor, she found a place that did her scans for under $100.
I leave the room, I put my clothes back on, I go out to the lobby, and then they said, all right, here's your scans. I mean, they're literally handing them to me within that time it took me to put my clothes back on, my scans, and they handed me a bag with two chocolate chip cookies in it. I was like, what? Like, and cookies?
These are just two of the stories featured in season two of the podcast, An Arm and a Leg. Dan Weissman is with me tonight to talk about the podcast and the eye-opening experience of the horror stories of dealing with healthcare as we know it. So I start, Dan, why did you start this podcast?
I started it because this is kind of number one issue in my own life. For a long time, my wife's had her own business, and that's meant that I've had to have a job, kind of job, that has health insurance because we need that kind of stuff.
Right.
And there came a moment where I'd left a job and I was like, damn, I'm in the kind of field where I might need a new career. There might not be another job for me that makes any sense in this town. And going off my own is scary because where's the health insurance? So I gave myself, like, I had this one idea, which was, I'm not the only person in this kind of mess. And I gave myself a week to just talk to people and say, like, what do you think? Could this work? And they didn't talk me out of it. And so I kept giving it more weeks to get more people to talk me out of it. Nobody did.
The story of healthcare, I mean, obviously, you know, your personal story of why you got in there is one that kind of gets tossed around when you talk about Obamacare and other places. That was the whole concept to help the freelance gig economy. But it's a story that, as you started saying, I'm doing a podcast about healthcare, more stories about healthcare came out. It wasn't just about the gig economy. It's about a lot of other things.
Everybody that I talked to had a story of their own. I tell a guy when I'm at school drop off, I'm like, I'm thinking, like, oh yeah, you know, my wife makes a lot less than I do, but she's got good health insurance, and that's important because we moved a couple years ago, and I felt a little short of breath, and that was weird. And I went to the doctor, and they were like, you had a heart attack. And he walked out with what would have been a $300,000 bill for surgery, but he had health insurance. But he was like, if I didn't have the health insurance, I wouldn't have made the call. And they told him, if you hadn't made this call, the next time you would have had occasion to call us, you would be dead.
As a reporter, as you hear these stories, does it mount in your mind about the severity of healthcare and the healthcare issue in this country?
As a reporter, I hear a story like that, and I'm like, hot dog, man. You know, that's material. It's great. It's good copy. It's good tape. But, you know, over time, I definitely experienced, like, this is pretty heavy.
Yeah.
And I mean, we all walk around with it. I don't know what your situation is, but you seem to have a pretty nice job. I hope they take good care of you with the health insurance. But, like, I mean, reading about it, definitely, as I developed the show, I was like, I knew I was – our family was precarious, and I knew a lot of people were just like, okay – I hope this job works out. I hope this career change works out because the healthcare is really important. But what came out too was like stuff can just hit you. You think you're okay. And then suddenly it's like, nah, that wasn't covered. Or, oh, we're going to fight you on that. Or, ah, we pulled your coverage for this. Or your share of this is $20,000.
That's the part that I want to know more about because, you know, I think a lot of people who do have healthcare through their insurance for their work and insurance carriers, things like that, they don't recognize that there is a large percentage of Americans that don't have health care, that are just going without it, and having to make choices in their life because of it. Chronicle a story of a couple that they don't want to call the ambulance.
They were pregnant. They had been very, very careful. Before they got pregnant, more than a year before they got pregnant, they're like, we want to get pregnant. And the woman was like, and I want to go back to school. But her job was the one that had health insurance. The husband had his own business. They sat down for days and looked at everything on the Obamacare exchange. And they were like, can we make it work? Can it go? Should I keep this job? And they were like, no, we can do it. And then they were like, we want to have a baby next year. Well, okay, which of these plans should we go for? Like, we should decide where we want to have this baby now. We're thinking we can get pregnant next year. We should decide where the kid's going to get born now so we can figure out what insurance to buy so that where we want to have the kid is where we have coverage. And they did that. They spent days doing this.
Hmm.
And they paid the premiums and they paid the premiums and they paid the premiums. And then they kind of switched the account they were paying a premium from. Like, this is now, fast forward a year and a half.
Yeah.
She's pregnant and everything's great. They switched the account they're paying the premium from. They write a check. They send it by mistake to the hospital instead of the insurance, which are this owned by the same company.
It's an honest mistake.
It's
right.
an HMO.
Right.
They send it to the wrong place, and they're like, great, okay, we paid that premium. They pay the next premium, and there's a second hiccup with that one, which is for a couple days, they're overdrawn on that account. But that's the day when the check comes in. Mm-hmm. They don't know. They think they've paid their premium. That all goes down in September of 2018, in October 2018. Couple weeks into October, they get a letter saying like, oh, you're canceled. We didn't get your premium. Mm. You're done. And we were dropping you as of a month ago. Goodbye. And they're like, what? Like, we paid this.
Right.
We paid this already.
Pregnant.
And we're pregnant. Yeah, like, And they call, and the people at the insurance are like, you bought this through the Obamacare exchange? You got to call the people who run that for the state. And people at the state are like, no, this is something with the health insurance. You got to talk to them. Back and forth, around and around. 2 weeks. And then they're like, okay. Like, no one's helping us. No one's doing anything. Okay. The baby's not due till January. We are signed up for new insurance for next year. Let's hold our breath. Pregnancy's going well.
And let's try to make it to January.
And make it to January. Do the math. Like, we're going to have some prenatal visits and stuff. Like, call ahead. Ask about every blood test. We need to do it. How much is it going to cost? And they start doing that. And then, a couple weeks later, she's coming home from work and she feels something weird, which turns out to feel like, she didn't know this at the time, her water breaking. And, you know, she gets home, she checks her underwear, and there's blood in her underwear. And that's when they call the ambulance. Or rather, he calls the ambulance and she's like, no, tell them not to come. We don't have health insurance. We can't afford that.
There's a great, and this is in the sound of them telling the story, that they kind of put their hoods up or whatever. They kind of walk past the ambulance coming up. Like, yeah. we're just innocent. We're just walking by. We didn't call the ambulance.
Ambulance? What? Yeah.
Not us. I mean, these stories that you hear and these stories you're collecting for the podcast,
They're all variations of this, this idea of how to live with and without healthcare. When you hear these stories and you collect them and you say in the podcast, there's many more coming. I mean, they're just, you never run out of material. As a former business reporter and someone who has definitely paid attention to the way that our systems work, are you alarmed by all these stories?
I mean, it's like a lot of things, right? Like climate change. It's like, I'm alarmed and I get up and go to work every day. Yeah. And, you know, all kinds of things. Like, it's alarming. It's like crazy. And so, okay, great. Like, I get to chronicle all this. For me, I'm just like, a lot of material here. This could be steady work for me.
There's another story, too. There's so many stories. You can check it out at armandalegshow.com. Dan Weissman is with me. He's the host and executive producer. There's another story just about, and a lot of stories that are around how much these things cost. And that's really the theme here. But this idea that if you go in for any sort of surgery or procedure,
basic tests
you're talking about without health insurance, thousands and thousands, and in some cases hundreds of thousands of dollars. And people have been faced with that, and they just kind of get to the idea of why it costs this much money. Why does, you know, when you're going to have a colonoscopy, which everyone says you have to have, that when you look at the raw numbers of it, they want $50,000. Like, what is that? I don't understand why that is.
Yeah. Well, yeah, such a good question. Like, why is that? So, I don't know about the $50,000 colonoscopy,
sure,
in particular, but that's alarming. That's great. Wow, who did that? Can we talk about that later? That's a good one. But this is how I understand it, right? It's basically, okay, a couple things. One, if you're the doc or the billing administrator, whoever's setting the price, you're like, well, I know I'm going to submit this for insurance, and they're going to tell me, like, no, we're not going to pay that whole thing. We want a big discount. Well, okay. How am I going to give them a big discount if the price I give them is anything close to my actual cost? So I'm going to set the price wherever. I don't know what they're going to say yes to. Let's see what I get. That's one. A woman I'm working with now, Elizabeth Rosenthal, who's amazing. She's the editor-in-chief of a group called Kaiser Health News, and she wrote a book called An American Sickness about all this, and she reported on it for the New York Times for years. She said to me, she was like, she asked the CEO of a hospital in California, why you charge so much for a hip replacement? And he said to her, well, you never know when a Saudi sheik is going to wander in with a suitcase full of cash. It could happen. Like $50,000 for a colonoscopy, somebody might give it to me. I don't know. It could happen. So that is actually one of the big reasons that happens, is like, don't get it.
Because it's such a major part of the society we live in and the economy that we live by. You would think that there would be more specificity or at least detail to the regulation of this kind of work. And as you see it with the stories being told, more often than not, it is all speculative. It is all, I'm just going to kind of make it up and see what happens, which is a strange dichotomy, right? To think about how important it is and how this has to be a part of everybody's lives. But at the same time, everybody's just kind of winging it.
It's capitalism, baby. Right? I mean, it's just like, whatever, like, okay, it's a business. I'm making a living here. I'm out here in the marketplace. The people I'm dealing with, I mean, another way of looking at it is like, look, I'm a hospital. I'm trying to keep my doctors in line. I'm trying to meet my costs. I got this insurance company. There's some kind of financial shark run by some Wall Street guy breathing down my neck. They're going to look over every damn thing that I send them. I got to maximize, you know, I gotta play the game because I'm playing it with the players.
If you don't play it, you're being played. Right? Doing this podcast and going into season two, which starts this month, I'm fascinated about this concept that we don't really pay attention to our healthcare because there are so many ways that we're insured or, you know, I get it through my work that if I go to my doctor, what I'm paying is not what they're charging.
Right.
And my situation is different than yours, and it's different than Pete's, and it's different than everybody else who might be listening out there. Yet we don't necessarily come together as a society and share this knowledge. It almost feels like it's private information that we don't want to necessarily talk about our healthcare with each other. What is it about that I don't understand the healthcare system and I almost ignorantly choose not to?
Well, I think there's two things. And one of them, I mean, come right to mind. And one of them is like, I don't know, Justin, man, that's like my gross body stuff that I don't feel like we need to talk about. It's a little embarrassing, and let's talk about the Cubs or something. I mean, that's one, right? Right away. And the other is, you know, in my own life, I don't want to think about this. You know, I feel like I am old enough. I grew up in a world where, like, and kind of became a grown-up of sorts in a world where, like, you pay somebody a premium for health insurance. You go to the doctor. It's not a major financial decision every time you have a cold or a funny ache. like, you're just like, okay, I'm going to go to the doctor, and maybe, they charged me $100. You know, I got a $100 deductible. Like, that sucks. But, like, you know, anything that happens, any, you know, I got to get a colonoscopy, like, sticker price, and that's, I mean, let's talk about the $50,000, because that is really interesting. But, like, what's the sticker price going to be? What am I going to get charged? And how do I even find out? Because even when you have insurance, you have a deductible a lot of the time, which is a part that you pay before they kick in anything. And one of the ways that things keep ratcheting up is the sticker price goes up on the doc or the hospital side. The insurance company's like, okay, you know, we'll pay what we'll pay of that. They turn around to whoever's buying the insurance plan, paying a premium, being like, got to jack up the premiums, dude, because the prices are going up. And if you've been shopping, for health insurance for yourself, you might be like, that's a lot of money. And they're like, well, I tell you what, we could raise the deductible. Mm-hmm. Then premium's lower, right? And so, but now, so it's not uncommon.
Which is 6 1/2, but
right.
Yeah.
Now it's not at all uncommon for people to have $1,000 deductible, $3,000 deductible, $10,000 deductible. I mean, this is like, I don't know. I mean, I bought my last car for $4,000. You know, that was a big decision. I don't do that every year.
Right.
You know, and if this car goes, you know, we'll think about whether we replace that car or not. But like, yeah, I threw out my knee playing basketball. Like, well, that's going to be that. That's your $4,000 deductible right there.
Right.
Yeah.
You started this last fall, and it was really a way to explore the same stories that was happening to you as families had to make a choice on what they were doing with healthcare. You're now into season two and several stories that you've helped tell on the podcast. Have you changed your view of the healthcare system and healthcare in general based on the work and the stories that you're hearing?
It's such a good question. I feel like not in a basic way. Like, I started out, this sucks. And I'm still like, this sucks. And I also start out with like, this is ridiculous and could be entertaining to talk about in the right way. And I still seem to be oriented that way. So I think not in any kind of basic way. I feel a little less in the dark than I did. Like this stuff that we're talking about how the prices keep ratcheting up. I feel like I've learned that through doing this. Like I'm a little savvier. But like every time I pick up the phone and talk to somebody, I'm surprised. People who know the insides of stuff, I'm like, I had no idea. And there's still stuff. The episode I'm writing right now is about prescription drug prices and how they get so high and so crazy. So I'm always surprised. And the amount of stuff I don't know is so crazy because it is also, I think, because it is capitalism. It's everybody seeking a side deal and a hustle and a workaround. And there is just no end of stuff to be worked around and no end of ways people improvise around it.
Dan Weissman, longtime reporter, business reporter. He's working Marketplace over at PRI. And, of course, his podcast is called An Arm and a Leg. You can find it at
arm and a leg show.com.
Season 2 is out this month. Dan, great to see you,
Justin,
as always,
you.
Thanks for coming in. Man.
Thanks, man.
All right, coming up. Here on Extension 720, we'll talk with Dr. Shelley Jane, who is the author of The Unspeakable Mind, Stories of Trauma and Healing from the Front Lines of PTSD Science. She's on the forefront of research and science when it comes to this, and really asking the question and exploring this question, her science and her research, of whether or not PTSD and trauma is hereditary. We'll talk about that coming up here on Extension 720. That's coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, so stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In her new book, The Unspeakable Mind, Dr. Shelley Jane delivers a comprehensive and definitive guide to post-traumatic stress disorder. PTSD science has come a long way in the last decade, but to act like it's new is to not have paid attention to human history. Ancient societies have long written about traumatic stress. It's mostly noted in the history of war, phrases like combat fatigue, being shell-shocked, even the term flashback. Today, we know more than we've ever have about PTSD and what causes it, and it's certainly a huge issue for the military, but PTSD can also show up after a loss of a loved one, physical and sexual assault, child abuse. But science is going a long way to identify PTSD beyond the effects on the brain. As Dr. Jane notes in her book, it's not a mental disorder brought on by poor lifestyle choices or moral weakness or character flaws, but instead a complex interplay between genes, biology, and environment. This is not a brain disorder. Scientists have discovered that it affects your cells, your organs, other parts of your body, and it could be generational. Dr. Shelley Jane is one of the foremost scientists working on PTSD today. She currently serves as the medical director for integrated care at the VA, Palo Alto Healthcare System, also as well teaches at Stanford. The book is called The Unspeakable Mind, Stories of Trauma and Healing from the Front Lines of PTSD Science. And Dr. Shelley Jane is my guest on Extension 720. Dr. Jane, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So it's not a coincidence, and I love the book, but it's not a coincidence that the word unspeakable shows up in the title of this mm-hmm. book. I never thought about the way we use the word unspeakable, unspeakable crimes, unspeakable acts, and this idea of not recognizing trauma and the things that go associated with that. Talk about how we as a society in the past have used that word in different ways.
So, you know, I think humans are hardwired to deny traumatic events. You know, it's a lot of times traumatic events represents a violation of everything you hold to be sacred and dear, and so when you live through one, there is this inclination, they're just too terrible to utter aloud. They are unspeakable. And sometimes the survivor wants to speak up, but the wider society isn't ready to hear them. Mm-hmm. You know, when we think of like really stigmatized crimes like sexual violence or child abuse. So then the events become unspeakable because of that. The problem is PTSD thrives when trauma remains unspeakable.
There's a great point you mentioned just about the human being that wants to not speak of these things, but at the same time, that wants to. There's this like this real desire for us to shout to the rooftops of what happened to us, but it almost feels like when we are involved in traumatic events, our first inclination is to suppress it.
Yes, and that's, you've really hit on an important point, because a lot of times survivors, they'll oscillate between those two points, right? On one hand, they want to deny the event, they want to forget about it, they don't want to think about it. But on the other hand, I do think there is this innate human desire. When there's been an injustice, you want to narrate to the world and let them know what happened to you. So survivors often switch between the two viewpoints. As a listener, it can be really chaotic to listen to that story. It can make you really uncomfortable because mm-hmm. you can't make sense of it. And that's why, unfortunately, a lot of times throughout history, trauma survivors, they've been deemed not credible and people don't listen to them.
And they also probably lose confidence in telling that story because people are not accepting or understanding what they're trying to say.
Yeah, absolutely. If you don't have a good listener or someone who can bear witness, you're going to think twice, because there's a lot of vulnerability in sharing that story.
I mentioned in the intro just this idea that ancient civilizations and societies, for all the talk of PTSD in the last decade, even since the war in Iraq, and it became a name for trauma, for traumatic stress. Everyone kind of feels like, oh, it's new, this is something. But when you look back and you see, and you have done this in ancient civilizations and the way that they have known about traumatic stress and named it different things, mm-hmm. it's kind of alarming in the way that this has been a part of the human existence since the beginning of time.
Yeah, absolutely. It has been, but it's really elusive. It kind of slips in and out of our social consciousness. And I think, you know, getting a hold of it and keeping it there and not forgetting about it is so crucial, because otherwise we lose ground. You know, so for example, every time there's been a war, like World War One and World War Two, and then Vietnam, there was this increased surge in interest in trauma and traumatic stress, and then it just goes back down again. Mm. And so it's accrued so many names, like you said, shell shock, battle fatigue, you know, battered women syndrome, child abuse syndrome. But the problem is, when it's all wishy-washy like that, you got to give it a name to be able to study it, right? To be able to cross that sea of myths, you need measurement, you need to define something, you need to study it. And I think that's why it's so important that we give it a name and we keep it in our kind of collective consciousness.
From the scientific community, it's also important, because how active have they been in the past of studying this? I mean, because you're right, it comes up at wars, World War One, World War Two, Vietnam. Were scientific communities interested in traumatic stress at that point, or is it more just an easy way to categorize people who are affected by it?
I think there's always been interest, you know, so people like me who are interested in behavioral health and mental health issues, I think there was always curious, you know, psychiatrists and trauma scientists who were noticing, hey, what is this? We need to pay attention to this. But then when attention shifts, the problem is, you know, you can't get funding to support your ideas, you can't get people to listen to mm-hmm. you, and then it becomes this fight. Now, what's important to know about PTSD is it could impact any of us, but the socially disadvantaged are the most vulnerable. And I do think there is this kind of political social element that, well, who cares if mm-hmm. women and children or people from low socioeconomic groups are having to deal with this? And it was a lot of advocacy work, Vietnam veteran era advocacy groups, women's rights groups, they were pivotal in bringing this diagnosis into the kind of diagnostic Bible in 1980.
You're so right, too, because it really feels like our society, when you think of even the 70s and 80s, I'm only thinking about the life that I know, those kind of shelters or any sort of resources that were allocated to battered women, to child abuse, to even war veterans, was on the fringes. It was always very, my mom is a social worker, she was a part of it, they never had funding. It was always ancillary. It was always trying to get some sort of money for this. And it almost feels like it was almost a society's way overall as humans of suppressing, not unlike the victims did.
So true. So true. You know, PTSD can operate on a denial of it can operate on a societal basis, too. It's not just individual. And you need legal rights, right? I mean, there was a time when it was not illegal for a man to assault his wife, you know, and so you need legal rights for the victim to be able to say, well, look at the consequences. So in some ways, I feel like we live in better times. And definitely, if you look at like digital platforms and the internet, I think we're hearing a lot of voices that before we just never would have heard. And so in some ways, there's been this kind of democratization of PTSD, which I think can only be a good thing.
It is a good thing. But again, it almost feels like there's misunderstanding or misinterpretation from a mainstream world, the mainstream news. It will always be categorized as a mental disorder. It'll always be categorized as psychological in some form. People can't handle what they saw. But there's so much more as the science reveals the impact, the biological impact it has on people, that not unlike addiction and what we're learning about addiction, that it's less about a choice or the mental fortitude and more about an illness or something that has a full long-standing impact on the human body that you can't control.
Yeah, and we've come a long way in understanding this. I think one of the first things that often get misinformed about PTSD is just because you're exposed to trauma doesn't mean you have PTSD. That is incorrect, and I think the term gets used too much. The reality is the vast majority of humans will recover naturally after exposure to trauma, even a horrific trauma, the worst thing. Humans, by design, were psychologically resilient. The vast majority will recover, but a substantial minority will not, and they will develop PTSD. And a lot of what determines who does and who does not, believe it or not, it's genetics. A third of that is determined by genetics, literally how we're wired in our brain and how our body mounts a response to stress determines whether or not we'll develop PTSD.
That's a fascinating point that I think a lot of people, myself included, that PTSD is something that is diagnosed after the person hasn't recovered on their own.
Yes.
Meaning that, you know, I may be a victim of trauma or had trauma in my life, but my body, because I'm resilient, I'm a human being, it takes whatever that finite amount of time is, it cycles out. But when it doesn't cycle out, and it may be because of genetic causes, that's when the scientific and medical community gets involved and gives it a distinction or a designation.
Yeah, that's what you would hope. There's still millions of people who never get a diagnosis, never get access to mental health care. That's a whole other issue, but that's what you would hope. And typically what happens is like a month, 6 weeks, 8 weeks after experiencing the event, the person is not getting on the road to recovery and the symptoms are getting worse and worse, and it's impacting their ability to love and create and work and play. And that's when, you know, it enters the realm of a psychological condition that warrants the attention of a mental health professional.
I'm going to take a break, and when we come back, let's talk about what some of those symptoms are. When you get to the point when you're at 8 weeks and there's checklists, there's other ways that the scientific and medical community can diagnose PTSD. In studio with me, Dr. Shelley Jane. She is the author of The Unspeakable Mind, Stories of Trauma and Healing from the Front Lines of PTSD Science. She's my guest tonight. We're talking about PTSD here on Extension 720, so stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest, Dr. Shelley Jane. She is the author of The Unspeakable Mind, Stories of Trauma and Healing from the Front Lines of PTSD Science. We're talking about PTSD, not necessarily as you know it. So the reason I really love the book is that it did challenge my own understanding and my own notions about what PTSD was. And I even think about growing up in an era when this would have been late 70s and early 80s, where Vietnam vets were ostracized because of their flashbacks, because of their unstable, or at least their perceived unstable behavior. And we saw this, and I don't know, there was a point there where you didn't necessarily say that's a disorder. You just almost chalked it up as that's what war does. I don't know what it was. It just wasn't necessarily categorized the way we're talking about it today.
Yeah, so I feel like, you know, naming it tames it. And that's why it's nice to understand the symptoms, because then you can understand the behaviors. So, you know, rather than saying people are quote unquote acting weird or right. quote unquote acting crazy, which is very stigmatizing and distances people from them, if we can get into the experience that the human being's having who's experiencing traumatic stress, you can have a lot more empathy. Because if that happened to any of us, we would be exactly the same way.
Right.
So, you know, in terms of symptoms, the ones that PTSD is famous for, like, is, say, like nightmares, and this is when they replay the trauma in their sleep every night, and these can be really disabling. They can get them a few times a week for weeks, months, years after the trauma. So you can even start to imagine just the impact on their quality of mm-hmm. sleep. So nightmares, they're famous, flashbacks, where they're literally reliving the trauma in the present moment. So even though they might be in front of you, they are reliving something that happened in the past, and they may act out. So if they may act out a battle scene, or they may start to run, or they may start to scream or shout. Really disorienting experience for the person who's having it. And then exaggerated startle response, that's another one. You know, right. they hear a car backfire and they hit the ground because mm-hmm. they assume that it's a bomb going off, or they assume that it's gunfire. So the body is reacting before the brain has a chance to even process what is going on.
The book, and it says it right in the stories of trauma and healing. Mm-hmm. There are personal stories in here from you and working with patients and others. Tell me about Rita. The reason I bring up Rita is because part of this, too, is about people who don't understand what trauma has done to them mm-hmm. or that they're even experiencing PTSD or are part of it. Mm-hmm. Rita came in, and I forgot what she was even coming in for, but when you started going through the checklist, yeah. you started to recognize.
That was a moment for me that I was really naive about. If you look at the epidemiological work that has been done on trauma exposure alone, it's actually really common. Something like 50% of women, 60% of men in America will say that at one point in their life they survived a major traumatic event. And there's a subset who survive many events. So the reality is if you go through your life and you don't experience a major trauma, you're actually part of a very, very, very lucky minority. And that was an experience I had when I was a fellow, when I was training to be a PTSD specialist, that I would go through this checklist and I would ask patients about every trauma they would have been exposed to in their life. And I was looking at this checklist and I'm like, really? Who's going to answer yes to all of this? Right. Like, but then I was going through it and I was astounded. And this patient who was Puerto Rican and a woman, she had to sift through 50 years of memories. And actually, when I asked her, she was like, oh, yeah, I witnessed my cousin die in a car accident, or she herself was a survivor of intimate partner violence. And here we go. And it comes out, and forget the current trauma that she was here to get help for. And that was a really eye-opening moment for me. And even for her, it was only when someone asked her and she pulled the memories that she was like, boy, I've been through a lot. So this speaks to the human brain and body's capacity. You kind of habituate to what your circumstances yeah. are, right? We're trained to survive. And if that's what it is, we get on with it. But there is a psychological toll and an emotional toll that we have to pay attention to.
And there are so many great stories in this book, one of which, and there, of course, Rita's, there's the other story about a woman who you saw, who was in, he was in the emergency room of the hospital, who had severe abdominal pain, mm-hmm. right? Just this idea that none of the medical community could figure out what the pain was coming from. They do a test, they do everything else. They're like, I don't know what, and this is, I'm sure a lot of people listening have gone to the doctor for some reason or another and said, this hurts. And they're like, I can't help. I don't know what's, everything looks fine.
Right.
And then you got a chance to talk to her. And again, trauma plays a role.
Yeah, absolutely. So for many people, the way trauma manifests is physical in the body, you know, with physical pain, with symptoms, abdominal pains, migraines, headaches, back pain. Because especially, I think, when the trauma is very unspeakable. And in my experience, where I typically see this is when people have survived pretty severe childhood trauma, where for children who are young, their brains are developing, their bodies are developing. A lot of times the only way they can deal with the trauma is to literally put it away, lock it away, and throw away the key and kind of dissociate from it. But yeah, it has a way of catching up. And a lot of times you'll see this with this manifestation of pain, which is not explained by your kind of general medical workups, you know, the x-rays, yeah, the MRIs, right. the scans, everything's normal. But I think the important point here is it's very real. These people aren't making it up.
That is a big problem. Yeah. I can't tell you how many times, whether it be me or my loved ones or friends or whatever, talk about that they've got some sort of back problem, knee problem, whatever it is, and the medical community is like, we looked at it and it's fine. I don't know what, it's in your head. And they're
insulting me.
It's insulting, yeah. But there is a peelback. There is a way that what you're talking about in your work and in this book, that many of these patients have survived or have been exposed to some serious trauma in their lives, and this is how it's manifesting itself.
Right, and the trick really, rather than shutting it down, oh, well, there's nothing we can do for you because we've done all of our checklists and you're fine, you got to be curious. You got to open up the conversation, because a lot of times the person themselves may not be connecting the dots. And the thing is, this doesn't go just for PTSD. It goes for, like, depression. Mm-hmm. I mean, so many mental health conditions can manifest physically.
In this line of work, when PTSD is not new, but the distinction is new, and you're learning new things through the science each and every day, how do you make sure, or how do you discern it? How is it different than, say, depression or other things that may be in the same category or close to disorders that are similar to PTSD? Mm-hmm. How do you make sure that it's not just something that's an acute case of depression or acute case of something else and not necessarily based on trauma?
Typically what you'd hear in the story, that there was some significant trauma. So you'd screen for the trauma. So that would be one hint. Mm-hmm. And those symptoms that I was talking about earlier, the nightmares, the flashbacks, the exaggerated startle response, they're very textbook PTSD.
And they're very unique.
Very unique to PTSD. Yeah, right. You're not really going to find that in other health conditions. The other element of PTSD, the thing that's very unique to PTSD, is this construct of avoidance. Like, a lot of people will build their life to avoid any reminders or triggers of the trauma, because that's the only way they can get through life with this, like, tunnel-like focus on just getting through. They don't white-knuckle it through life. But they'll avoid, you know, for example, if they're combat survivors, they'll avoid crowds. They will avoid people who remind them of that period of their life. Emotionally, they'll constrict their lives. They won't want to love. They won't want to experience joy. They will mute their happiness.
Which leads to other things like depression.
So, great point. PTSD and depression often go hand in hand.
And drug use. And
PTSD and addiction often go hand in hand. Right. So it's very common, very rare for me to meet someone who only has that. They all go hand in hand. They're all related, but there are some distinct features of PTSD.
The one area that I think a lot of people listening are glued to is the generational or the hereditary part. Mm-hmm. That this is beyond just something that one person experiences the trauma. Once the trauma is experienced and your body almost rewires itself around it, it has the ability to pass on to the next generation or to the people around you, to family. Mm-hmm. That's the part that I don't think people have wrapped their head around. Mm-hmm. That trauma doesn't just affect one person. It can affect many.
Yeah, it's infectious.
So let's do that. We'll talk about that coming up. Dr. Shelley Jane's my guest. She's the author of The Unspeakable Mind, Stories of Trauma and Healing from the Front Lines of PTSD Science. And she's my guest tonight in Extension 720. We'll take a quick break, come back, and continue the conversation. So stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio tonight, Dr. Shelley Jane. She is the author of the book, The Unspeakable Mind, Stories of Trauma and Healing from the Front Lines of PTSD Science. As she would know, she currently serves as the medical director for integrated care at the VA Palo Alto Healthcare System, as well as teaches at Stanford. She's been involved with PTSD science really your entire career. I mean, this is something that you have really sunk your teeth into, to be something that you are dedicating your work and your knowledge and your career to. Why do you do that?
So in terms of the clinician, like, I've been a doctor for 20 years, and that's part and parcel of your life. You meet people who have suffered trauma all the time. So the clinical part for 20 years, the science part more for the last 10 years. So I have a personal connection to the field because I have my own family history of trauma and tragedy in the 1947 partition of British India that I only came to know of.
It's a great
story. 2007. Yeah. So I took a road trip with my dad to celebrate his 70th birthday. He was visiting from England, where I was born and raised, and he still lives there to this day. And he started narrating the story of what happened to him in 1947, started telling me about his family upbringing in India, where he was born and lived as a boy. You know, I'd always known that my paternal grandfather had been murdered in the kind of horrific violence that accompanied partition, but I really only had nuts and bolts of the story.
Just bits and pieces throughout your life, right?
So disconnected from it. And again, now as a trauma scientist, I see that's the way trauma is. You're so disconnected from it. I was raised in England, thousands of miles away, didn't have much to do with India, no connection to my ancestors because they were dead, mm-hmm. right? So,
and they coordinated it off, meaning this is how I'm going to live my life without having to think about it.
But yeah, I mean, it was hard enough kind of growing up in England when you're an immigrant kid, and it was just hard to find a connection to it. You know, I didn't have any photographs of my grandparents, didn't have any heirlooms, like nothing to latch on to. So I just really thought, well, okay, that story, I didn't know how to make sense of it. Mm-hmm. But on this road trip, by this time I was a psychiatrist, and what was fascinating about the way my dad narrated the story was that there's a lot more cohesion to the story. It was very much thoughtfully kind of laid out. It was stripped of the anger and the bitterness and the fear that used to accompany it when I was a kid. And I realized it for what it was. By that time, he was the sole surviving member of his family of origin. So what he was giving me was testimony.
And he said afterwards that that was on purpose. Like, he wanted to tell you this story because it was important to you and your family and who you were going to be.
Right. And he felt strongly that, you know, if you have an education, if you have a platform, if you have a voice, you should really use it for something of value. And that's what he felt strongly. And for me, my way of kind of processing that was like, well, okay, I'm a doctor. Like, okay, why don't I become a PTSD specialist? Why don't I try and advance the science of PTSD?
And advancing you are. I mean, this is, we're getting to the future part of this conversation, is what's going to happen next. Because there are treatments available for PTSD. It's whether it be therapies. There's been trials and clinical trials with medicines and pills and things like that. But there does seem to be, because, and this goes back to the same thing we're talking about at the beginning of this conversation. When you put a name to something, it seems like the scientific community, there are more people getting involved in this, that there seem to be more studies and more even governmental intervention, meaning they want to know more about this stuff. It seems like a different time in 2019 than, say, the last time that people got interested in traumatic stress.
Yeah, it is a good time, and I'm optimistic. I think this is a great time to be in the field of PTSD. We've really benefited from this massive surge in science since 9/11, since the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, since like major natural disasters like Hurricane Katrina. Huge growth in the science of PTSD, and all types, like you said, not just pharmacological or neurobiological, health services research, epidemiological research. And that body of evidence just continues to grow exponentially. So it's really good times. I think we're getting much better at knowing how to
let's get back to the generational point. This is a part that kind of blew my mind about the book, that it is, because just as we're talking about, the trauma is not necessarily mental, it is physiological. It travels throughout the body. It's genes, it's biology, it's everything we learned in biology class in high school. But this concept that because of that, it can be passed on to next generations and next generation, that trauma almost becomes part of your DNA.
Yeah, so there's this fascinating field called epigenetics. And, you know, I should say we're still early days, but it is really enticing. There's enough out there that I think it's safe to say that, you know, when a man is exposed to a major trauma and develops PTSD, or a woman is, it has an impact on the man's sperm and the woman's eggs. And because of that, changes are passed down via this process called intergenerational transmission to any future offspring they might have. And these changes manifest in the form of like altered neurobiology, altered genes. So the kind of stunning thing is that their offspring can kind of carry these sorrows in their own blood, even though their kids may never be exposed to a trauma. But if they were to be exposed to a trauma,
it could trigger whatever is in the DNA sequence.
Yes,
right?
They're going to respond to the trauma with that cumulative history, right? Family history. So when you think of mass traumatization, when you think of torture, slavery, genocide, right?
It's a great point, right?
There you go. So then PTSD's deep footprint can last generations.
Now, again, our society plays a big role. We saw in how society has, even in the word, in the name of this book, with unspeakable, there's some traumas that we just don't have answers to, so we're like, just push it down. When you talk about this intergenerational or just generational DNA being passed down from trauma to trauma, and you think about things that are just awful, whether it be genocide or slavery and things of that nature, do we risk politically the world tamping that down, because that's what human beings do, and saying this is not necessarily where we don't want to know more about this. Let's just put this all away.
It's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Right? Because it brings up a lot of, like you say, very controversial and kind of provocative topics in our culture. But, you know, just because something's uncomfortable doesn't mean we shouldn't pay attention to it, right? And I think that's where we can have most movement. If we're curious, let's just be curious. No one's saying we've got the science of epigenetics down. There's so much more to know. It's still an evolving piece. But let's not ignore that what we're finding. And the first lesson for me is, we have to take care of women who are pregnant. We have to take care of young children. Like, these are the first major lessons, you know, that all these processes are just so vulnerable to being disrupted.
You mentioned earlier, and we kind of glossed over it, but when we talk about PTSD, a lot of times it almost, I'll have conversations, and we've done this many times on this radio, that PTSD and military are hand in hand. Mm-hmm. It's all about soldiers coming home and, mm-hmm. and transitions mm-hmm. and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. Rarely does PTSD and trauma be almost attached to people living in poverty. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, people who have dealt with trauma in some form. We just had Alex Kotlowitz in, and we talked about the traumatic stress that happens to people who are living in Chicago where there's gun violence,
oh, yeah.
but are left behind, mm-hmm. meaning their friends, loved ones, mm-hmm. family, things of that nature, that mm-hmm. not the victims or not even the shooter, but just and part the shooter. Mm-hmm. But this idea that there is all this trauma that nobody is paying attention to, that is festering and building up
right.
because of things that they witnessed, that they're a part of, that lived through.
Right. So, like you said, you know, of course, our military personnel have high rates of PTSD yeah. because of their occupational exposure to trauma.
And first responders, too.
First responders, right. police, firefighters, low-income women and youth who are raised in high-crime, inner-city areas where there's a lot of poverty, they're really high-risk, too. So we forget that piece of it. And so, you know, if you're growing up in an environment where you're not sure if you're going to be safe, like literally your life could be threatened, where people you love are maybe being murdered on the street, and you're dealing with loss and grief, and you're growing up in that, your body is going to be mm-hmm. reacting the same way you would to, you know, it's a trauma in itself, and your mm-hmm. body is going to be developing and reacting in that way, and you're going to have the same kind of consequences. And that's where access to mental health care is huge, because a lot of times people who live in impoverished areas do not have access to adequate mental health care, don't have access to adequate health care, period, right, never mind right. mental health care. And that's why your zip code is huge. Zip code goes a huge way in determining your ability to be resilient in the face of trauma.
Do you feel, as you mentioned, the cumulative effect of generations? Let's say you're in a position where you are someone who lives in a high crime area, mm-hmm. and you develop, obviously, PTSD from the trauma that you've experienced mm-hmm. in your young mother, mm-hmm. lose a loved one in some mm-hmm. form. They pass it on to the next generation. Mm-hmm. That generation is faced with their own trauma mm-hmm. in that moment, and there's mm-hmm. a trigger to where all of the cumulative effect of that's in the DNA sequence, you can understand why the pattern continues. You can understand why, without adequate health care and mm-hmm. mental health care, that people are having adverse effects to trauma, whatever it might be, meaning that more crime, more erratic behavior, whatever it might be, mm-hmm. there you can start to see a sequence that is different than the, I guess, the storylines that have been fed to the media about what is happening in some of these areas.
Well, you definitely get a sense for the vicious cycle nature of it, right? And how entrenched it is.
Right.
And I think you just get a bigger perspective that it's more than the trauma we're dealing with in the moment. There's a history here that is impacting the picture we're seeing at the
right.
moment.
Right.
So, you know, the next question becomes, how do we break these cycles? We have to. And I definitely feel, you know, there's no need to be like, we don't need to feel fatalistic about this. You know, I don't think we're just we're a walking, talking product of our genes. We need to intervene.
Right.
Education is key. Access to mental health care is key. Elevating the mental health literacy about PTSD to the general public, which is a big part of the push to write the book, frankly, you know, getting more information out there. So we do have this option that we can break this cycle, but it's going to require a lot of collective will. I don't think any one individual is going to be able to do this by themselves.
As you look at the future of PTSD awareness, but also cures for PTSD, is it going to come in the form, as you kind of mentioned in the book at one point, blood scans and CT scans? I mean, is it, or blood work? Are you going to be able to know about the trauma and whether or not someone is suffering from just comprehensive labs?
So that's the dream, right? And that's kind of the direction that a lot of hardworking people in my field are trying to go into, where we get very precise about biology. And, you know, the same way we have a blood test to show whether or not you have diabetes, and we can monitor your progress, or we can do a scan to see if you have a tumor. You know, that's the direction that people want to go to with psychiatry, that, you know, we want to have a blood test, and we want to be able to, you know, diagnose really quickly and be very definitive about it. I'm really hopeful for that time, but I'm also a pragmatist. I don't think that time is coming anytime soon, but we need people. We have people who need help today, and we have to find ways to help those people right now.
What are they? I mean, is it what's available to someone who is suffering from PTSD right now?
So talk therapy is the gold standard. You know, mm-hmm. if I had someone in my life who I loved with PTSD, I would want them to have access to a well-qualified therapist who could offer talk therapies. There's some specific ones, like EMDR is one, PE is another one, CPT. These are very tried and trusted therapies for PTSD that have been shown to be effective in controlled trials. So that's like kind of the gold mm-hmm, standard. Mm-hmm. So that's a great place to start. Just because they're effective doesn't mean they work for everybody.
Right.
And then there are some other types of therapies that don't focus on the trauma as much. They focus more on the consequences of the trauma. So how to manage your day-to-day life and your emotions and your relationships in that kind of trauma-informed way, but maybe not looking directly at the trauma, because that is very difficult for a lot of people. So there's other options in terms of therapies. For many people, medication still is an option because sometimes the physiological arousal is just so much. The idea of sitting and talking about mm-hmm. it's just hard for people to get there sometimes, and medications can really help take the edge off of symptoms.
And it's really about the symptoms, right?
Yeah.
Right.
And there's many reasons. You know, sometimes for people it's a luxury. They can't come for therapy 10, 12 weeks in a row. They've got small kids at home, or they've got jobs, or they're in school, or they don't have gas money. I mean, there are so many factors. Right. So medication is definitely an option too. And then there's a lot of interest, really intense passion for a lot of mind-body treatments. The data that we have for the mind-body stuff is not as robust as I would like to see, but they're definitely very popular, and a lot of people are saying that they're incredibly helpful. So things like yoga, tai chi, meditation, that kind of thing, acupuncture.
Well, it's going to be fascinating to see where the field goes when it comes to traumatic stress and PTSD. Dr. Shelley Jane is a part of that community, and she continues to be one of the foremost experts on PTSD science. The book is called The Unspeakable Mind: Stories of Trauma and Healing from the Front Lines of PTSD Science. Dr. Jane, thanks so much for joining us tonight. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me. It was my pleasure.
Back to Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
A couple of programming notes. White Sox and Cubs, of course, tomorrow and Wednesday. We're back on Thursday. We have a big show on Thursday. Now, we got a couple big shows we've been working on. Full shows, three-hour shows. Thursday show, we don't really have a title for it yet, but it'll be about addiction and recovery. And we are collected a couple interviews. It's really, I mean, just really hard to listen to, kind of personal stories, both of you know, addiction and recovery, about no hope and hope, if you will. So I don't want to paint the picture that it's just all sad story. It's about what they've learned from their own story, and you know, going from the dark to the light. So those conversations coming up on Thursday.
Lots of introspection in recovery.
Lots, and in these conversations, and we've been collecting them, Pete and I have been collecting them over the last couple of weeks, just because we've had the time off to do so.
Yeah, you know, one of the people you talk to is an acquaintance of mine.
Oh, there you go. So, it's pretty powerful stuff. I mean, to listen to people tell their stories and to give them the space to do so. It's also a big part of recovery as well. So that show coming up on Thursday. And then next week, we have a couple of shows. We got one, which we're kind of centering on the theme of longevity. And that's going to be great because the band Superchunk, which is one of my favorite indie bands from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, they will join us coming up, talk about their illustrious career as they turn 30, which is crazy to think about. It's 25 years since their great album, Foolish, and now 30 years since they started. So we'll talk about that. And then our Pride show, which will be coming up right during sort of Pride Week, right before the parade. Really looking at 50 years after Stonewall, but more importantly, looking at the Chicago landscape of the gay and lesbian scenes here and how it's changed over time since Stonewall. A lot of great voices, great characters, and great scenics. We're going to get out of the studio and talk about that history coming up next week. So we've got those shows. I've also filling in with for Steve, for Mr. Cochran, for a couple of days coming up in June and July. So I'll have those as well. So lots to do here on 720 WGN. And, of course, tomorrow, is it tomorrow that Roe and Anna are going to the John Barleycorn? Roe's putting his flannel on. He's going to have his backwards hat. He's going to...
That's going to be quite a look.
He's going to walk in like, oh, hey, what's up, everybody? I love the Cubbies. I love the... There's nothing better than the pregame broadcast, radio broadcast at a bar in Wrigleyville before a Cubs Sox game, right? Not just to listen to. That's a great thing. But to be there, I feel like that has been... it's just such a great history of Chicago radio to be the remote in front of big events. Like, I remember going to Gurney Mills when Gurney Mills opened to see Stephen Gary. I skipped school that day. It's like a senior ditch day kind of thing. You know, just kind of walked out of second period, like, just keep going. Get to the parking lot and keep going. I don't advise that to all the kids out there listening, but...
You are a true radio rodent.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's not said in a bad way.
It's in a good way.
It's in a good way. It's
so like, I feel like the broadcasts that are opening day are legendary, of course, but having any sort of radio broadcast, there's nothing that stirs the heart and soul like walking into a bar, packed bar, and there being a radio table, you know, with guys on headsets doing their broadcast live.
That can be thrilling and terrifying all at the exact same moment.
It depends on where you're at, which side you're on.
Because you never know what's going to happen exactly. Next.
I might go up there tomorrow. I mean, we don't have a show because of the Cubs and White Sox, but we have got some things we got to do in the afternoon. But it would be good to get a piece of Barleycorns. Are you going to go up there? You know, as a Cubs fan, Pete, are you thinking about Wrigleyville's where you want to be during a Cubs Sox rivalry?
No, but if you're going to go to the Barleycorn, I'll go to support the Roman.
I know the problem is just getting out of there. You know, like, getting up there is one thing, but then...
That's why they invented public transit.
Yeah, I know, but that's...
Although now it's gotten more interesting, because in the old days, they didn't close down all the streets before the game or after the game unless it was a playoff.
Right.
Or the World Series.
Now they do it all the time.
Now they do it all the time. So, public transit becomes more challenging, at least by bus.
Yeah, we'll see what we can do. Maybe we'll do that. We'll figure it out. We got some time to figure. We got less than 24 hours to figure it out, so we'll do so. All right, coming up, Pete McMurray in tonight, and we'll have Pete and continue here on 720 WGN. Stay with us.